KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley.
Napa, California.
I live in the Castro.
Fillmore District.
Bernal Heights.
Oakland, California.
Coming up, supportive housing for homeless veterans and low-income families comes to San Francisco's Mission Bay.
You can't do anything until you get some sheetrock over your head. You can't get your life together living in a shelter or navigation center.
Then we'll trace how a history of racist government decisions led to institutionalized poverty.
Everywhere in the country, it created segregated projects, even where communities were previously integrated.
Recounting a forgotten history. And then we'll learn the story behind this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound.
Ah, come on!
Shove him!
Summer, partially!
I'm Fisit Fagiatoli of the family Fagiatoli, and I'm a bard.
That's coming up today on Cross Currents. Today, San Francisco began construction on the Mission Bay Housing Development, a complex that'll house homeless veterans and low-income families. KALW's housing and homelessness reporter, Liza Veal, was at the groundbreaking ceremony earlier today.
The weather did not stop housing leaders from gathering under a muddy tent to celebrate new housing for homeless vets and low-income families.
And so, thanks for coming out of the rain, and of course, the folks who will be living here will be out of the rain, right?
That was Michael Blecker with Swords to Plowshares, one of the nonprofit partners on this project. Jane Kim, the supervisor that represents the neighborhood, says this building will bring 62 vets out of homelessness and protect 56 low-income families from ending up on the streets.
To ensure that families who are the fastest growing demographic in our homeless count today are also a part of this project.
This project came together under the late Mayor Lee's administration. Lee faced criticism over the issue of homelessness, but Kim gave him credit for specifically targeting veterans.
The one arena that the mayor was incredibly successful in was reducing the number of veterans on our street. We've already made a huge dent in those numbers, and this project is going to provide a permanent home to men and women who serve our country.
To honor that, Mayor Mark Farrell announced that this project will be named after the late mayor.
We are formally dedicating this affordable housing site to our mayor, Edwin M. Lee. And when these buildings are completed, they will bear his name on them here in San Francisco.
But the celebration couldn't mask the fact that this project is just a drop in the bucket. There are still about 4,500 people unsheltered citywide. And only 800 or so supportive housing units become free annually through turnover. Land prices in gentrified San Francisco make housing for homeless people expensive to build. Each one of the units on this site costs nearly $700,000. The Mission Bay neighborhood in particular is going through tremendous development. The Warriors are coming soon, as is a UCSF research campus and medical center, retail, and over 6,000 units of housing, 30% of which are targeted to be affordable. And another permanent supportive housing site wasn't received very well. As Cron 4 reported last May,
a homeless housing proposal just blocks away from AT&T Park has some people in the area very upset.
Neighbors organized an opposition campaign to the housing, misconstruing it as a shelter.
Had I known that they were going to put in a homeless shelter with a psychological element, I might have made my investment somewhere else.
That project is still slated to begin construction in early 2020. This one, the Edwin Lee Housing for Vets and Low-Income Families, will be completed in 2019. Del Seymour, a client and board member of Swords to Plowshares, hopes the neighbors will welcome the new tenants.
You can't do anything until you get some sheetrock over your head. You can't get your life together living in a shelter or navigation center. So that's temporarily keep the rain off your head for just a minute, but it's not a way or an exit to housing. It is not exit to housing.
As a client, Seymour was served by Swords to Plowshares, substance abuse and housing programs.
I walked into Swords 27 years ago, a broken down veteran, and they've helped me get through my transition back to a better life.
These units will do the same for their residents. At least, that's what the Reverend Fong, a nonprofit partner on the project, is praying for.
May the spirit of peace,
peace.
Joy.
Hope,
and love.
Love
embrace this wonderful new, what's the name? Ed Lee Veterans and Family, whatever. You know what I mean. Anyway, this place.
In San Francisco, I'm Liza Veal for Cross Currents.
Liza is KALW's housing reporter. If you'd like to get in touch with her, you can at housing@KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Did you know that Richmond, Milpitas, and Palo Alto all had subdivisions where it was illegal for African Americans to own a house? Those are some of the racist policies Richard Rothstein takes on in his book, The Color of Law, a forgotten history of how our government segregated America. Many of the Bay Area's segregated low-income neighborhoods can be traced directly back to discriminatory housing policies either created or enforced by local, state, and federal authorities. Richard Rothstein moderated a panel discussion on housing this week at the conference Race and Inequality, the Kerner Commission at 50, hosted at UC Berkeley. And he talked about the racist legacy of American housing policy on the program Your Call with KALW's Rose Aguilar. Here's what he had to say.
Public housing in this country began in the mid-20th century in the New Deal during the Roosevelt administration. It was the first civilian public housing ever built, and it began as a project for working-class families, not for poor people, for people who had jobs, but in the Depression had no housing. And it was mostly for whites, and the federal government built the Public Works Administration, one of the first New Deal agencies, built the first civilian public housing in this country, and everywhere in the country it created segregated projects, even where communities were previously integrated. There were many integrated neighborhoods in the mid-20th century or early 20th century. We would be stunned if we were transported back to that period and saw how much integration, residential integration, there was, for the simple reason that working-class people didn't have automobiles to get to work, so they all had to live close enough to the factories where they worked or the other workplaces. And so if you had a factory that was had Irish immigrant workers and Italian immigrant workers and Jewish immigrant workers and African Americans, they all had to live in roughly the same neighborhoods near the factories. So Langston Hughes, the great African American poet, novelist, playwright, wrote about how he grew up in an integrated downtown Cleveland neighborhood. We don't think of Cleveland as being an integrated place. He said his best friend was Polish. He dated a Jewish girl. That neighborhood where he grew up, an integrated neighborhood, it was a neighborhood where the Public Works Administration demolished housing and built two separate projects, one for whites and one for African Americans, creating segregation that previously hadn't existed and might not have existed if that hadn't been done. And this pattern was created everywhere in the country. Cambridge, Massachusetts, we think of it as being a liberal area. The area near MIT was also an integrated community, about half black, half white. The Public Works Administration demolished housing in that integrated neighborhood to build two separate projects, one for African Americans and one for whites. Well, this continued for the next 20 years. And by the early 1950s, we saw development everywhere in the country that there were large numbers of vacancies in the white projects and long waiting lists in the black projects. Eventually, the situation became so conspicuous that all the projects were opened up to African Americans. And about the same time, industry left the cities, and there were fewer and fewer jobs for the people who were living in these public housing projects. They became poorer and poorer. And then for the first time in about 1950, public housing began to be a subsidized program for people who couldn't afford private housing, and almost all black at the time, and without jobs and without hope, without opportunities, being concentrated in these downtown areas. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the federal government was subsidizing the movement of white families only to single-family homes in the suburbs. The Federal Housing Administration recruited mass production builders, people like Henry Dolger here in the San Francisco area, to build the Westlake development in Daly City, or San Lorenzo, a a bit earlier, but still with the same Federal Housing Administration policy. A builder named David Bohannon built that. And the FHA, in order to grant the guarantees for bank loans for these developers to build giant developments, they never could have assembled the capital to build a development with tens of thousands of homes in one place on their own. The Federal Housing Administration gave them guaranteed bank loans on condition that they sell no homes to African Americans, and indeed required that the deed of every home in these developments include a clause prohibiting resale or rental to African Americans. So there were many, many other policies that the federal government followed and state and local governments followed, but these two, the Federal Housing Administration creation of the suburbs on a white-only basis, and the Public Works Administration and succeeding housing agencies concentrating African Americans in central cities where they became poorer and poorer, created the metropolitan landscape that we see today. You talk about the image that we have of African Americans. Well, white families, whites generally, look at the way we've concentrated African Americans, although they don't understand that it was we who concentrated them, we the government of the country. They look at African Americans living in poverty without opportunity, and they assume that this is characteristic of African Americans rather than understanding that this is the product of an explicit government policy. Mm-hmm. There were many, many African Americans in the early 1950s, late 1940s, who could have afforded to buy those homes, the single-family homes that the governments were creating in places like Westlake and San Lorenzo or others in this area and throughout the country. Levittown is probably the best example, east of New York City and well-known. Many African Americans could have afforded to buy those homes. They were very inexpensive. They were cost about $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 at the time. That's about $100,000 in today's money, about twice national median income. Working class families of either race could have afforded to buy those homes. African Americans were prohibited from doing so, required to continue living in urban areas, renting apartments either in public housing or in private market. And whites were subsidized. The subsidy to whites was so great that they could leave public housing, which, as I said, was not for poor people at the time. It was for working class families. They could leave public housing and move into single family homes in suburbs like Levittown or Westlake or San Lorenzo and pay less in their monthly VA and FHA mortgages and other housing costs, pay less for housing in these single family homes than they were paying for rent in public housing. So we created this situation, and African-American neighborhoods became more and more overcrowded, as well as depressed because of lack of employment opportunities, more and more overcrowded because they were restricted in where they could move. There were no opportunities outside urban areas. As they became more overcrowded, conditions deteriorated in the communities. City services typically declined at that point, less garbage collection. They became slums. And whites looked at these communities and decided that African Americans were slum dwellers and therefore should be avoided. But this was all the product of government policy. This was not something that happened naturally. It was not something that happened by accident. It was not, as we commonly think, something de facto. It was a legal creation, just as the segregation of schools or the segregation of restaurants or the segregation of transportation was done by government in the 20th century.
Richard Rothstein is author of The Color of Law, a forgotten history of how our government segregated America. You can hear an extended version of that conversation with Rose Aguilar on KALW's Your Call by going to kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba, and now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. All week long, we've been playing you this sound.
Ah, come on!
Shove him! Shove him!
Summer, power shove me, power shove me, power shove me!
My character at one point had pirate hunters, pirates, and the entire kingdom trying to kill him.
We got one team, he's coming to kill me. One.
I'm Fajit Fajitoli of the family Fajitoli, and I'm a bard.
Think you recognize that? It's the sound of a secret fantasy world where knights, wizards, and druids battle for glory right here in the Berkeley Hills. KLW Audio Academy fellow Lilia Vega takes us there.
Cordonesis Park is a few blocks north of the UC Berkeley campus. To get there, you have to surmount this steep hill. The farther up you go, the wilder the terrain becomes. The trees become lusher, the sidewalk buckles from the pressure of giant roots, and on some early mornings, this whole North Berkeley area is swirled in fog. And if it's a Sunday, you might hear something like this. Right by the side of Cordonesis Creek, in a clearing just off the main path, is an assemblage of heroes. Warriors and wizards, barbarians and bards locked in battle, swords and staffs in hand. But if you look closer, you'll see the weapons in their hands are made out of foam, not steel.
We're all here to just hit each other with sticks and act like idiots.
That's Jacob Lee, the organizer for today's event. These are LARPers, or live-action role-players. No one's trying to kill anyone. They're here to play a medieval-themed combat game called Amped Guard.
All the parts of the core that are able to hit someone need to be padded with a certain amount of padding, because we're in reality a full-contact sport, right? We're not pulling punches. If you watch someone swing, we're actually trying to hit the guy.
In this world, Cordonesis Park is the mythical land of Wyvern Spur. Amped Guard is like a game of Dungeons & Dragons come to life. Instead of a board, players fight on real terrain.
If you think of it as like a video game, then you'll imagine those as game objectives, right? Things like spawn points and capture points, things like that.
Where do we reach spawn?
A lot of Amped Guard is in the imagination. But even though the swords aren't bare steel, they're real. Luel Senores knows this firsthand.
I once knocked someone's tooth out, but they said it was loose already. I was mortified. And they're like, don't worry, we all signed the contract, we knew it happened, and it was loose already anyway. So I'm like, oh, okay. Headshots aren't allowed in the game, but accidents happen, and you hear a scream and you stop.
You okay there?
Yeah. Are you okay? Oh, actually,
lighting five.
It's hard to look pretty and dodge blows at the same time. So most people are dressed pretty practically. But Luel is an exception. He's got on a pair of steampunk goggles, chainmail, and a sash with medallions that jingle with his every step.
What are these? Belly dancer belts? I believe that you get from the Renaissance fairs. So I purchased one of those because it matched the color scheme.
For some, LARPing really is about the sport or the physical exercise. For others, it's a social club where they get to meet new friends. And for some people, it's all about escaping into a fun character.
Well, I'm Fajit Fajitoli of the family Fajitoli, and I'm a bard.
That's Frieden Kresch. His character is an impish bard called Fidget.
My character at one point had pirate hunters, pirates, and the entire kingdom trying to kill him. It was a whole bunch of mistakes that led up to it, but basically I might have accidentally tried to assassinate the king.
It seems like he gets into a lot of trouble.
Fidget is not intelligent. So he just kind of does things impulsively and starts fights, which in the LARP community actually is a lot of fun.
Ah, come on!
Shove him!
Power shove thee!
There are lots of Amped Guard communities around the Bay Area. Fidget's from Ashen Spire, which is another park in Fremont. Both Ashen Spire and Wyvern Spur are part of the Greater Kingdom of Westmarch, a.k.a. California. It's pretty common for players to travel from kingdom to kingdom. James Mesquita is visiting from San Antonio, and he's been LARPing for 30 years now.
You can travel, when you get to that extent,
almost anywhere in the country and say, hey, I need a place to crash. You know, can I come crash with you? I want to go out and fight the next day. And so really like the family that you build, like doing this kind of stuff to me has turned out to be one of the more kind of important things about it.
So Wyvern Spur is just one small barony in a larger world of duchies, principalities, and kingdoms. But almost everyone here agrees that there's something special about this Berkeley spot. Sure, there are anachronistic elements like park benches, a barbecue grill, some safety cones, but it's pretty easy to lose yourself to the forest around you.
When I first started AmpGuard, I remember the reason I came back, the reason why I remembered it so vividly as such a different experience, is because there's something about when I got onto that field where there were literally 30 people in the field, where we were literally fighting in a forest that I had to hike through. And I remember that experience of running through the forest. And I didn't even remember anything else except running through the forest, playing this random game, and loving it to death. And I remember us fighting literally until the sun went down. And the reason we stopped was because the sun went down and we actually couldn't see anything anymore. And we're like, okay, there's no lights here. We gotta go.
In the Kingdom of Westmarch, I'm Lilia Vega for Cross Currents.
Thanks, Lilia. Well, we didn't receive any winning guesses this week, but we still want to hear from you. Where do you think Audiograph should record next? Give us a call. Let us know. Our number is 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. And that's our show for today. Our Cross Currents team includes Angela Johnston, Marisol Medina Cadena, Nina Gensler-Debs, Truk Nguyen, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Andrew Stelzer, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are James Rollins, Jackie Sajiko, and Gabe Graben. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by the band Gaucho. They perform at Brenda's in San Francisco's Tenderloin District every Sunday from 5 to 8 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.